may have noticed that local authorities have been sharpening their pitchforks and gathering fiery brands as they attempt to oppose a new piece of law which would give government power to impose functions and standards on them. Government's position appears to be that local commissioners and councillors shouldn't be able to shirk their statutory responsibilities, and Legislative Council has been drafted in to try to broker the peace. Later in the programme, we'll find out why a Timwell committee is gently nudging government to properly register all the land it owns and considering whether government knows what it owns. But first, the Local Government Amendment Bill. Here's Rob Mercer, MLC, introducing Clause 5 in last Tuesday's LegCo sitting.
Clause 5 amends the Local Government Act 1985 by inserting a new Section 4B into that Act that empowers the Department to, by regulations, require a local authority or joint board to perform a specified function that it has discretion to perform. Such regulations would require Timwell approval. This amendment was inserted during its course through the House of Keys. It should be noted this amendment has initiated concern amongst the local authorities. This resulted in an evidence stage where this chamber was able to receive evidence to enable us to scrutinise the provision and the concerns of the local authorities in more detail. Mr. President, I know that this chamber and the department has listened to those concerns. The department believes that there are sufficient safeguards surrounding the use of the clause, i.e. the requirement for consultation and for Timwell approval of any regulations made under it. Honourable members may further note that due to the commencement provisions in Clause 2, Clause 5 would not automatically come into operation on the announcement of Royal Assent. In order for the Department to bring into operation Clause 5, an appointed day order would be required.
MLC newbie Gary Cluett moved an amendment to Clause 5, as did Tanya August Phillips. We'll hear from Mrs. August Phillips later in the programme, but this is what Mr. Cluett said in the debate when defending his clause.
I admit I do not have a lot of experience here or, you know, over the last number of years observing Timwell and the branches, but I don't recall, and I don't know too many people can recall, any piece of legislation, any clause in any piece of legislation that has met with such resounding fury and concern as the Clause 5 as it was approved in Keys. So part of this, to some extent, is a peacemaking thing, is that, you know, we want to ensure, we believe that what we are proposing with these amendments, what the Clause 5 as it sits at the moment, assuming that even without point four being approved, is fair, reasonable, just, and will work. But this is really just as an additional level of assurance.
MLC Rob Mercer offered support to all the amendments, but clarified that the sponsoring department of the bill did not support Mr. Cluett's amendment.
The department believes the proposed amendments do provide additional safeguards to the operation of Clause 5, which it understands will help to address a number of the concerns of the local authorities. I am pleased to put on record the department does support those amendments. I'd also like to thank the Honourable Member, Mr. Cluett, for bringing forward his amendment and for his comprehensive contribution just now in debate. Speaking personally, I agree that the idea of introducing reviews such as this into legislation is attractive. Post-legislative scrutiny is established elsewhere in other jurisdictions, and our own chamber has recently conducted its own post-legislative review of charities legislation.
The Attorney General was asked to clarify what new functions and standards could be transferred through Clause 5, as there was concern that Clause 5 allowed the transfer of any functions to local authorities.
Honourable members will be aware that should the department intend imposing a duty to perform a specified function, it may only do so where the vires for performing that function already exists. As were that not the case, there would be no legal basis for the local authority or joint board to perform that function, and to require it to do so would be unlawful. And so it's not correct to say, as I have heard this morning, that Section 4B proposed could be used to introduce new duties. Some services provided by local authorities are, as a result of legislation, obliging them to provide those services. But others result from legislation giving the local authority the power, but without necessarily the obligation. And so there is no compulsory provision. But any specified function would have to have a basis in legislation already, whether it's mandated or one where the legislation gives the local authority the ability or the power to provide those services. It's not a question of new services being imposed. It is also true that the exercise of the power in the proposed section 4B will be reviewable by way of dolience, whereby challenge can be brought by any affected party who believes that the decision maker, in this case the department, is acting beyond its powers, or that the process leading to the making of any regulations was in some way unreasonable, or that the process was improper or unfair. Although it is also true to say that my research suggests that where the regulations made by the department have the approval of our national parliament, then a successful challenge by way of dolience is perhaps less likely. Another issue raised by Amendment 4 concerns its requirement for a review of the merits or demerits or effectiveness of the operation of the new section by the Council of Ministers, I think 3 years after the new section comes into operation. According to the amendment, the culmination of the review will be a set of recommendations by the Council of Ministers to Tynwald as to whether the section is to be retained as it is, or modified, or repealed. But, Honourable Members, of course, Tynwald would be well within its rights to ignore any recommendation made. If the recommendation is, for example, that it be repealed, it falls to the Department of Infrastructure to bring forward a bill to repeal it. There is no procedure whereby Tynwald can introduce a bill in its own branches of its own volition. Rather, a government bill is introduced by a member of the executive branch, invariably a department's minister.
After the sitting, I caught up with MLC's Gary Cluett and Paul Crane. First, we hear from Mr. Cluett.
You successfully amended the Local Government Amendment Bill 2023. Now, this was in response to a fairly full-on evidence session that you had with the local authorities, in which it's fair to say there was a unanimous view that Clause 5 was not something that they supported.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was quite, as I said in just now, I can't recall any other issue, in, not only here, but in even most parliaments, where there's been such universal condemnation of a particular clause. And I actually can see the concerns being raised. You know, I take the current minister at her word when she says there was no intention to use these powers beyond what they were stating. But I've always been sceptical or cautious about things where, you know, what happens when a future minister comes in and decides, because typically, you know, government tends to take the broadest possible view at legislation once it's been passed, because it's easier than introducing an amendment to do what you specifically might need to do. So I'm pleased that we've gotten through this. You know, it became about what sort of safeguards can we build into this, as I have explained both during the evidence session and this morning. You know, with 22 votes in Keys, I'm mindful of just saying, no, we pull that out. I don't know how much time, how much consideration they gave to the real impacts. They certainly had not been exposed to the pushback from the local authorities on Clause 5. And so, you know, we've done our best to amend it to impose some fairly significant guardrails and to prevent abuse and to give, you know, local authorities an assurance that, no, we are all in this together. We're not about dictating to you how you should do things, and that if you need to do something, we all need to sit down and understand what it is, what the financial implications are, what the operational implications are, who's going to do what, and just take it through a normal process. I know the department was not particularly happy with my amendment, which was to put the review kind of a mini sunset clause, but basically put in a review of the operation of that legislation starting 3 years after it comes into effect. Now, it's not going to come into effect on day one because it requires a separate appointed day order. And, you know, my understanding is the department would not do that until they actually needed to do it, to use it for something. And at that point, they need to obviously put into effect all the regulations and various things like that. So it may take a while for that to come by. But the point is that the review period only starts after it comes into effect. So it's not on 3 years whether we've used it or not. It's 3 years basically after it's been brought into effect. I didn't buy the arguments that they were using that we don't need that. I think just because of the strong feelings and concerns that it was yet another guardrail to review it. As Mrs. August Phillips stated that, you know, post-legislative scrutiny is becoming more the norm in many jurisdictions, and we are including it in a fair amount of our new legislation because it makes sense to review laws every now and then to make sure that they're fulfilling the purpose for which they were designed. So all in all, I'm quite happy and I'm encouraged because it now goes back to Keys. And Keys will now have the benefit of, you know, our deliberations. They've all seen and heard the evidence session. They've seen and heard, they've been on been copied on most of the correspondence that has come from local authorities and even a few members of the public. They'll have time now to reflect on where things are, and hopefully they'll include our guardrails, perhaps add a few of their own. But I think altogether we'll end up with a far better bill that reflects the type of governance that we want between central government and local authorities.
Next, MLC Paul Crane.
You had made a contribution to the Local Government Amendment Bill, quite a lengthy bill. I think it's 50-odd clauses, lots of schedules as well associated with that. But there was one particular clause which seemed to raise particular concerns amongst local authorities.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, there was a clause 5 in the bill, which was introduced into the bill by the House of Keys coming through. So it hadn't been part of the original consultation. I really was not particularly aware of it until the bill was coming through to us, and then the correspondence started, and we had a lot of written communications from local authorities, from members of local authorities, individuals, raising this Clause 5 as an issue. There were one or two other parts of the bill, but Clause 5 was repeatedly there, calls for it to be removed from the bill and so on. So, yes, it's been an issue.
And you had an evidence session, you Legislative Council had an evidence session, and during that evidence session, it became clear that there seemed to be quite a bit of misunderstanding about roles and responsibilities on both sides.
I think that's probably fair to say. You know, certainly I'm where we have a difference between what appears to be the Timbal Chambers, although what I'm involved in is specifically Legislative Council and the local authorities, where there are differences of view there, I wouldn't like to blame either side for that. I think apportioning blame is pointless here. We do need to work together. You know, this is the Isle of Man's government. Some of it's at a local level, local government, local authorities. Some of it's at the Isle of Man national level. And, there are functions that are better suited to being provided locally, and there are functions that are not really things that should be discussed in a national parliament. You know, so we need to work together on this, and this is where it was disappointing. I think that was a word used by a couple of speakers this morning. It was disappointing that as we've gone through this bill, we've seen this gap in our aims, in our understanding, and so on. Where it hit home in particular, Legislative Council now has these stages. It's not just a sort of first reading, second reading, third. We have a principles stage where we discuss the principles of the bill, and then we move on, if required, to an evidence stage. And the feeling was, right from the start of this bill, we need to hear what these authorities are saying. They're telling us that there hasn't been full consultation. Well, okay, let's give them the chance to speak to us. So we organised this evidence session. The response from local authorities was such we had to hold it in the Tymwald chamber to give them enough seats. You know, our chamber wouldn't have been big enough to take that. So we had representatives from most of the local authorities there in person to talk through the issues they had, especially with this Clause 5. And when we got to the end of the evidence session, which was entirely about members of the Legislative Council asking the local authority representatives what they had to say on these issues, and it was very much a listening exercise from our point of view. Legislative Council members were not debating the issue between us, we were just taking the evidence. We got to the end of the evidence session, and when Rob Mercer, who's been taking the bill through, when he said, I propose we now move on to a clauses stage, and we had to vote on that. Yes, are we going on beyond the evidence stage to a clauses stage? And so there was a unanimous agreement that we were doing that. And there was a gasp from the room, you know, an audible gasp, people looking horrified, as if we'd just ignored what they'd said and passed the Clause 5. Well, that was not the case at all. You know, in order to discuss Clause 5, we needed to move on to a clauses stage, and that wasn't going to happen there in the evidence session. Our unanimous vote that we move on to the clauses stage was understood between all of us from the start, but I would say it hadn't been well enough communicated to the people who were there what the evidence session was about, you know. So it didn't help in that sense. We've had a few letters and emails since then saying, you know, this was terrible that Legislative Council hadn't listened. Well, we had listened and we were ready to move on to a clauses stage, but that's where we were at.
And I suppose had the local authorities been in Legislative Council on Tuesday to witness the discussion on the clauses stage, they would have realised actually, yes, indeed, Legislative Council have listened, because there were several amendments, particularly in relation to Clause 5.
Yes. Yes, Clause 5 was subject to most of the amendments made today, I think. After the evidence session we had, there have been a number of conversations in Legislative Council. We don't sort of share views. We don't work out in advance what we're doing here. You can see this morning there were people who had different views on different aspects, but inevitably we have a base that we use within the building, and we meet others there, and there are conversations that happen there. And I think everybody's been acutely aware of, there's issues here, you know. Some people have asked, I was asking just in the last few days, really, I've been asking, are others looking at voting against Clause 5? Because I wasn't sure, you know, where I was going, but I can see that. In terms of our understandings of the roles, I think many Tymwald members would love to see the local authorities, not with reduced puppet-like responsibilities, but actually developing into more powerful regional, and I say regional because some of the authorities are so small, they can't step up to anything, you know, in terms of size. And so we're keen to see the local authorities develop, to see local government develop and so on. And this bill, indeed in some ways Clause 5, is almost an empowerment bill. I know it was thought that it was too prescriptive and that the Department of Infrastructure was being given powers to require them to do things. But that was always subject to consultation, subject to Timald approval and so on. We've strengthened those considerably this morning with amendments from Mrs. August Phillips and Mr. Cluard. They've made some changes, so they've tightened that consultation. The consultation must now, it's required, it'd be in the bill if the Keys accept it going forward. It builds in that the consultation must take into consideration the financial and the operational aspects of any task they're being asked to do. But the fundamental problem is that if you're trying to get local authorities to take on a task, when the smallest has a population of just 400 and the biggest 26,000, they can't all do the same thing. So we end up with an inconsistency of services across the Isle of Man. And that's hard to live with, really.
One of the retorts, and you know, I suppose during this interview I'd best declare, obviously I'm clerk to, still at the moment anyway, clerk to Arbury and Rushen Parish Commissioners, and, you know, I had a view anyway because I was formerly the minister responsible for local government on two occasions. But you mentioned there about the range of services. Many of the local authorities pointed the finger back to the department and said, okay, if you want to introduce these powers for us, what guarantees are we going to have that you can deliver the services that you are statutorily responsible for delivering? And in many cases, local authorities could point to the department and say, actually, they're not really delivering.
I'm sure they could. You know, I wouldn't want to challenge that. I think this is, as I say, I'm not looking to apportion blame. I'm not saying this side do this and that side do the other. But I think what's important is that we're working together going forward on this, and we find a way to do that. I made the comment at one stage, it was an off-the-cuff comment, but in my role here in Legislative Council, I have very limited contact with local authority representatives, you know, and that maybe is something that needs to change. You know, I live in Mirown, but I don't represent the community in Mirown. Legislative Council isn't like that. I get invited to the local civic service, and that's about the extent, really, of my contact. I occasionally run into a local commissioner, but in terms of having any opportunity to discuss how they're thinking, how we're thinking, how things might develop and evolve, in terms of bigger thinking going on across the local authorities, I was involved in the Municipal Association because I wasn't around commissioners for 9 years, but I was involved in the Municipal Association, but it never had all the local authorities, you know. But it did some useful work of helping them understand each other with their different scales, different sizes, different problems, different areas, you know.
And another thing you referenced was that GARF, which was formerly two relatively small... parishes. Yeah. I'm coming to the third, and one middling-sized village authority. Once they merged, they're now... Well, you tell us.
Well, GARF has become the fifth biggest of the local authorities in terms of population. Okay, so the bigger authorities are in order: Douglas, then Onchan, then Ramsey, then Peel. And GARF is the fifth biggest, so it's bigger than Port Erin, it's bigger than Castletown, and so on. So it's become quite a sizable unit in the time that I was on Municipal Association. Yeah, we could see there the representative that was coming from the representatives from Macclesfield. They were working closely together and building a relationship, and they'd gone for this formal merger. But I'm sure it's that bigger unit, and well in excess of 4,000 people in there now, I'm sure they can offer more services and they can offer them more cost-effectively than they could as units on their own. You know, they're still part of... some bigger regional units when it comes to civic amenity sites and things like that, but they're a more substantial unit on their own. And I absolutely welcome that. You know, I think that would be a great way forward for some of the very smallest authorities.
As an agricultural man, or a farmer's son at least, I'm having in my head this picture of trying to to get some cattle to go through a gateway that they don't want to go through. If you go behind them and wave a stick and shout at them, chances are they're going to spread in all sorts of directions and not go where you want them. If you gently coax them and perhaps have a bag with some feed in that encourages them in the right direction, they're more likely to do it. Do you think the department is probably more the former than the latter in the way it's gone about this particular clause?
I haven't followed the details of what happened as the legislation passed through the Keys, but Clause 5 was introduced. I believe it was introduced with the best intentions, you know, that not so much about imposing on local authorities as empowering and getting them to step up to the plate, really. But I think it is important that going forward we're working together. You know, we're both local government and the national government, we are both looking to try and develop the Isle of Man for the people of the Isle of Man. You know, we should be absolutely on the same page here going forward, and we shouldn't have these differences. And where there's differences of understanding, well, we have to meet more often to for those to become clear, to become apparent and to be addressed and mitigated. Yeah.
That was Paul Crane, MLC. Tanya August Phillips, MLC, successfully moved several amendments to the bill. We have three items to talk about. The first is the Local Government Amendment Bill, and you moved several amendments to a number of the clauses, but particularly to Clause 5, which is this controversial clause. But actually, the bill itself has lots of other really quite interesting and useful things in it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think that that's kind of been lost in the mix a little bit with all of the conversation around Clause 5, because I think that Clause 5 has been very specifically the contentious bit. But saying that, I mean, what was put in there, a Henry VIII clause by amendment, by a member of Keys, and then having the government back that and not sort of... considering, I suppose, any further safeguard that might be needed there, I think that it was a really sound idea, but because of the way that it came through, wasn't necessarily given as much attention as perhaps it could have been. So I think that's where Legislative Council's understanding of it and needing to speak to the local authorities directly. I mean, we've literally never had an evidence session for Legislative Council in the Tynwald Chamber, which is what happened. And all of the local authorities, I think, were present or had submitted multiple pieces of evidence. And it was all in relation to this one part of the of quite a comprehensive piece of legislation that we've been waiting for a considerable amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, it does things like it improves transparency in local authorities. It resolves issues that had been a concern. I think there was a concern in Onchan over declarations of interest and things like this, which led to a report which has ultimately led to this piece of legislation. Mm. There are other elements in there too, allowing local authorities to lease public open space, and that doesn't sound like too big a deal, but actually the law on that is at best confused, and this new piece of legislation will clarify that. So it's much more than this Clause 5.
It absolutely is, and this bill landed into Legislative Council at the back end of the last administration, and Legislative Council were dealing with that bill at that point in time when, Purda kind of came in and we were waiting for the general election. I think what a lot of people don't tend to realise is that, you know, if they leave something hanging between the two branches in Parliament, a piece of legislation, that it will still have to go back through the House of Keys, the new House of Keys, and quite rightly so, because it's the democratic, directly elected branch. But if you want to leave something in Legislative Council, it goes through Keys. Go through council, you have Purda, you have an election, it'll go back to Keys after council's finished with it. So we kind of ended up in this strange position whereby Legislative Council was saying, it's going to go back to Keys anyway, So just send it back through the House of Keys now. We've not dealt with it properly yet. We've not. It's not been through all of the stages. Just send it back through to Keys now and let it go through its natural process, which quite frankly, for a piece of legislation of that gravity, what you would want to see is that the policy is defined well, handled well, and is got that narrative throughout the bill. And then it comes into Legislative Council, and Legislative Council then look at it with a fresh pair of eyes in a very different way. So the way that we would look at it is, okay, thank you for telling us what your policy is there and what you're happy with. We will now refine the bill to make sure that it meets your objectives. If it needs refining, then we will refine it to make sure that it's right. And we've got the benefit of having the Attorney General on council as well to be able to assist us in doing that engineering piece or that quality check, and then suggesting things back to the Keys for Keys to then decide on whether or not they accept any amendment from council, which, you know, again, is their right.
And I suppose the Attorney General, because he sits in the Council of Ministers, also allows you to understand what the Council of Ministers' position might be.
It does, yes. But at the same time, what I would expect out of the Attorney General is that when he's wearing his Legislative Council hat, I'd like to see him wearing his Legislative Council hat, as opposed to providing, you know, whatever it is that the Council of Ministers would or would not want. We've already heard that because we see the bill. The bill has already been through council as well before it landed in the House of Keys or whichever branch it would land into. They always approve it going into the branches along with Treasury concurrence and sort of, you know, any assessments that are needed as well prior to it landing. And we've frequently asked for the drafting instructions for the bill as well that are typically an awful lot more comprehensive than the bill itself, because they need to describe to the drafter, this is what we want, this is how, you know, this is how we want it, this is why we want it, these are the other jurisdictions that we've looked at, these are the things that other jurisdictions may not have looked at that we have looked at, and this is how we arrived at these positions. So they've already told us what they want, and so we don't really need to hear too much of that. But what we do need to hear about are things like, you know, are all of the derivations there? Why is it important to know where all of these different clauses came from? So they might have taken certain clauses from, say, Victoria or, you know, Californian legislation, or it might have come from Jersey or Guernsey or wherever it's come from. And then other ones they might have looked at maybe an English piece of law, and they might have, you know, sort of brought that through from there. We need to know what those things are. Where is it derived from? What is it? Why have we decided on that particular approach? Are there other approaches that could be taken that might refine and make it better? Those types of things, and also asking questions about wording in law as well, which is quite important, that the Attorney General acts almost as a bit of a mouthpiece for the legislative drafting team, quite frankly, yeah. Because they are the ones with the expertise.
Moving on then, you have two items on the Timewald Order paper. You are the chair of the Constitutional... I think you've just had an idea there, haven't you? The chair of the Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice Committee, and you are moving the first report of the 24-25 season. And this is surrounding land ownership. And for those of us who have been ministers or been in Timbald for a while at different times, we will be absolutely aware that Timbald doesn't, or government doesn't really know what it owns. It certainly doesn't have a clear record of what it owns.
Embarrassingly so, yes. Mm. I would say. I think it's a very, very difficult job. It's one that people individuals that have been responsible for this have sort of like left to one side, and it's been too difficult box. I mean, a couple of years ago, I think that they pulled together a team of people, and they looked at five different sites, priority sites that they wanted to pilot this with Land Registry from Treasury. And they looked at doing that. They figured out how difficult it was and realised that it was probably going to take a little bit longer than they expected. And then they just sort of left it for a bit. It really has been the too hard box situation that nobody really wants to get to grips with, but is actually very, very important that they do. And I had to explain not so long ago that, you know, if that recommendation one, which is around, you know, sort of getting land registered, government land registered, which is, by the way, for free. I mean, it's not the benefit that everybody outside of government that is, say, for example, purchasing a property and then has to pay for land registry if it's not been registered. You know, we have to pay considerable amounts of money to do that. Government doesn't have to do that. It doesn't have to pay for that. And they're not doing it. So asking them, it's already a recommendation that's been approved by Tim Wald in the first adverse possession report in the last administration from the same committee when Jane Paul Wilson, the now Justice and Home Affairs Minister, was chair. She brought the report and she had a recommendation in there that they do it by 2030. Now, this is extending this out by another 5 years to give them another 5 years to register government land. And the reception to that first recommendation was, well, you know, that's probably not enough time to get it all done. And I said, well, either you accept another 5 years or alternatively,
what you were supposed to do. Yes. And of course,
you can have 2030. That's all right. That's already agreed.
People listening the reassurance is that all the big tracts of land are reasonably clearly understood. The bits that are perhaps less clear are the little slivers of land alongside a highway somewhere. I know I, as in my still clerking role, we had an issue that we had to raise with the Department of Infrastructure recently. And, we don't own that. And I said, well, I think you do. And of course, there was no record of ownership. But what there was clear record of this particular part of the highway being used as a highway until maybe 20 years ago. That's the bits all around the island that are perhaps going to need quite a lot of work to get resolved. And of course that matters now because the department has changed its policy, Department of Infrastructure, in relation to management of hedgerow trees and you know, trees on verges and things like this.
Yeah, it's just another side effect, isn't
it? Yeah, someone, you know, it is necessary for people to understand government owns or doesn't own that particular piece of land.
Yeah.
So yeah, an interesting report. And I mean, there are other recommendations that you've got are generally about reforming the law, making it more usable. That
which is a lot of these are, you know, you go back to the first adverse possession report in the last administration, none of these are going to be a surprise to government by any stretch of the imagination. As soon as they found out that we were looking at this again, and what we're doing from Parliament essentially is saying, okay, well, you know, we gave you a number of recommendations. It's on the Tim Wald decisions list because we agreed a number of recommendations. And what have you done then? And the response is sort of tumbleweed. So it's about kind of like just trying to move these things along and ensure that there is momentum. And I think that, you know, that recommendation too, around the legislation, they have moved forward a bit on that. They, you know, there are a number of pieces of legislation that are going through in this back end of the administration. There's an awful lot of legislation that's going through at the moment. And so I understand that they've had to prioritise all of that, and I get it. But my own personal view around legislation, having been doing this job for probably about 8 years now, coming up to, is that, you know, we should have like a sort of a 10-year plan for legislation, really, as opposed to kind of a 5-year plan for legislation where we sort of literally have everything coming through at the back end before a general election. I think it's important that we all get it right. Draft as a gold dust, quite frankly, as well.
And just clarifying that point, I think we've had, is it about 14 bills have come through the branches so far, and this current session
that are in, they're in the branches. They haven't come out the other side yet.
There's 14 that have gone through in the last 4 years.
In the last 4 years.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm talking about now,
And then this year, how many are due for?
13 are in the branches at the moment. I have been told by the drafting team that there are 30 bills overall.
Yeah.
that they're expecting. So whether or not that plays out, I don't know.
But even with the best will in the world, that does sound like you're not managing your legislation particularly well.
I think that they've focused on a lot of secondary legislation throughout this administration. So I have to be fair to them that, you know, you had the sexual offences and obscene publications legislation, the domestic abuse legislation, the liquor licensing legislation. I'm just talking about Home Affairs here. I'm not sort of talking about the wider piece, but we had a lot of legislation that came again back end of the last administration. All of that then needed to be implemented. The guidance needed to be worked up for. It's all of the behind the scenes stuff, basically, that's not front and center. Secondary legislation was produced. There's been a lot of secondary legislation that's gone through in every single Tim Ward Court sitting that we've had. There's this massive push for, and has been for a long time, and it's not just this jurisdiction, it's a lot of the British Isles, actually, quite frankly, for skeleton enabling pieces of law, that all of the meat on the bones is in secondary and not in primary.
I used to love bills that said, and the minister can do whatever he wishes in relation to his particular area of responsibility.
Yeah.
Those, I mean, I think I can't remember when it was. It was something like a 1908 agriculture bill, which basically says, and anything else the minister chooses to do to support the agricultural industry
in this area,
which
whatever you want,
which was all encompassing and great. That, I mean,
was there
anything else in relation to that report, or should we move down to the other?
I think that actually the education piece around registration of land, I think that's really important. There have been a number of cases, and you know, we've thrown words around like vexatious litigation, and the cause and effects around sort of land and land registry or not registered land. I think it's really important that people do register their land if they can. But saying that, it is expensive.
Because
they need to provide
that
incentives.
That vexatious thing that you're referring to there, basically, there are some individuals on the Isle of Man who just go and decide, oh, there's a piece of land that's not been registered, I'll register it as mine. And that's a bit of a concern, isn't it?
It is a bit of a concern, yes. It's probably a bit more than a bit of a concern for some people. Certainly some individuals that I've talked to, that it's you know, in some places been quite affecting. And those are things that have sort of gone through the courts. But those individuals have won that case.
But it can be stopped by people just registering their land in the first place. So that
You don't realise how important it is until something like that happens to you. And then it goes through the courts, and because they legally, you know, they've won the case. Mm. They've won the case.
But it's still an awful lot of work and time and concern and worry, which could be resolved if the land was registered in the first place. And yes, it is going to cost you a bit of money to register, but compared with hiring advocates and fighting in the courts, it's probably a lot cheaper, isn't it?
Well, either you hire an advocate to do this, or you risk what could come from not doing so.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that I understand that things are very, very difficult for a lot of people at the moment. It's not going to be the forefront of minds. It's not going to be the top of the top of priority for people. But that's why, you know, in the recommendations, what we're suggesting is go away, think about some incentives actually, and for people to be able to do this. You need to start sort of providing carrots as well as.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Educate.
Then we move down to the Standing Committee on the Business and Functioning of the Legislative Council. And this is the first report for the 24-25 session.
Yep.
And this is in relation to Charities Registration and Regulations Act 2019. And it is fair to say that the evidence that you received suggests that maybe not all charities think that this has been a tremendous success.
No, I think it's been very difficult, but I think that the Attorney General's chambers have also done a reasonably good job as well. They've sort of picked up on problems as and when they've arisen quite well. there needed to be some form of tighter regulation. Whether or not what they ended up doing was the right situation is exactly what we were trying to figure out. And we had a lot of charities that contacted us. We're very, very grateful for that. A lot of members of the public as well that contacted us. We did put out a public consultation as well. We wanted those views in. We went through all of that and questioned the Attorney General in an oral evidence session in Parliament as well, in Legislative Council's chamber. We came up with recommendations for change to the legislation. Now, the reason why, just tracking back a little bit as to why this actually came about, is because I was quite interested in post-legislative scrutiny. So I pitched at the branch, wouldn't it be great, as we've not got an awful lot of legislation that's actually going through at the moment, and this was a good sort of 2 years ago, two and a bit years ago, as we don't have an awful lot going through at the moment and there's not an awful lot that's to be expected, why don't we start looking at evaluating some of the legislation that we've already passed to see whether or not it's working effectively and see whether or not there are any changes that might well need to be made to these pieces of law that we've worked so hard on. So this was one of it's right at the top of the list for everybody around the table, and it's mainly because we've had a number of individuals that have contacted us before that point. So we wanted to look at it. We had never done post-legislative scrutiny in branch before. So we've got a committee called the Business and Functioning of Legislative Council. And basically what we do in there is not talk about amendments or talk about bills that we want to bring, or, you know, in terms of like private members' bills and things like that. What we talk about is how Legislative Council functions, how we can do our job better, how we can scrutinise better, and is there anything else that we can do that might be useful? So post-legislative scrutiny became the thing that we can do that is useful when legislation isn't arriving into our branch. So what we said was, well, let's start with this one. And post-legislative scrutiny, just for those that don't really haven't come across the term before, is a term used to describe the practice of reviewing a piece of legislation after it's come into operation, evaluating whether a law has been implemented successfully and whether it's achieved the intended outcome. So you basically go right the way back to principles. So when this bill was first thought about, before it was a bill, before there were drafting instructions, when that first conversation, I want this thing, right? Okay, well, what parts of this thing would you like? And it's that we wanted to get to with the Attorney General's chambers.
Yeah, so effectively,
to set the criteria.
What is it you hope to achieve from the legislation by introducing this, and then has that actually happened? And
yeah.
I guess from the fact that you've got three recommendations making suggestions that maybe you think there's a few tweaks necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And we've talked about these with the Attorney General. Obviously, he's a member of our branch. But we took it through LegCo. Is LegCo content for this to go into Tynwald Court? We'd never provided a report like this before, an evaluation of a piece of legislation after between 3 and 5 years of it having been implemented. So we wanted to get that Keys view, and was very, very important to us. Also, there's a slight nervousness of, this is the first time we've done this thing.
Yeah.
So we should probably put it to the House of Keys to make sure that see what they think of it. We could have asked the Attorney General to just crack on with those changes from LegCo, but it didn't feel right. We're not the directly elected branch. We're indirectly elected by College of Keys, so we need to make sure that we do things right. We came up with three recommendations for change, all of which have been declared sensible by the Attorney General, which has been rather nice to see.
Yes. Well, that's very good of him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing the debate in Tynwald and seeing where you end up on both those items. I suspect you'll get support, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. You never really know with Tynwald at the moment, I don't think.
That's probably the mildest way of putting it.
Yeah, it is.
That was MLC Tanya August Phillips. So what do you think? Are local authorities protesting too much, and should they get their collective act together before crying foul? Is government really trying to offload services and costs to local authorities? Are you surprised that government hasn't registered all its land holdings? Does government really not know what land it owns? And has the charities law been a little too draconian in the way it was imposed? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Gunnar Myerson Geisha from. Thanks for listening.